The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
It's Cartoonerific. Cartoonerific. It's Cartoonerific. With your host, Brian Mitchell.
Well, howdy. You are listening to the Cartoonerific podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I am your host, Brian Mitchell, and thank you for joining us. You know, when I was growing up, when I was a little kid, I used to watch a lot of different animation. And some of those animated things that I watched were Casper the Friendly Ghost, Novel Toons, Harvey Toons, Terry Toons, Walter Lantz, Woody Woodpecker cartoons, MGM cartoons, not really until maybe later on, but Warner Brothers cartoons, Fleischer, Disney, of course, and, you know, The Wonderful World of Color. And I used to watch all this stuff, and when I hit 5 years old, I started having a preference to watching Woody Woodpecker and Warner Brothers cartoons and Disney cartoons and MGM cartoons. And I don't want to say I became an animation snob, but at a certain point, I just preferred those and I didn't want to watch anything else. But I also was raised on all those early Hanna-Barbera cartoons. So Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Pixie and Dixie, Mr. Jinx, Magilla Gorilla, the Flintstones, of course, and many, many more. And I liked Hanna-Barbera cartoons. I just, I liked the cartoons. I didn't find them funny until I watched The Wacky Races, which was, I think, done in 1967, 68. Somebody's going to correct me, I'm sure. But it was that show and Dastardly and Muttley and their flying machines also made me laugh. And, The Perils of Penelope Pit Stop, I really like. They were all kind of based off of they were sequels or spinoffs of the Wacky Races, cartoon show. And I really like that. And of course, Scooby-Doo. I think everybody likes Scooby-Doo. I was maybe 10 when it came out, or no, I think it was maybe 8 or 9 when it came out in 1969. And there were certain things that I liked. And then Hanna-Barbera kind of dissipated. Either I got older and I didn't appreciate the stuff, or the cartoons got just a little bit lame. And I tend to think, looking back, that they actually got a little bit lame. And it was because they had to produce so much product for Saturday morning that they couldn't really keep the focus on the quality. So the quality of the stories or the quality of the concepts and stuff like that. So whatever they went in with that they thought would sell, they would sell it. And, you know, and it's too bad. But they had their heyday, and their heyday to me was back in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s. So I wanted to do a show that was talking about those cartoons. And there is a blog called Yaup, the early Hanna-Barbera cartoon blog. It focuses on the early Hanna-Barbera cartoons. So everything pretty much produced between 1957 and 1962, 63. And that's what it's all about. They have basically Don M. Yaup, who that's not his real name, but he's basically using that name for our show today. He talks about all those cartoons with the Jetsons and the Flintstones and even Top Cat and stuff like that. And he also talks about the commercials on that blog. Well, that blog is a wealth of information. It's a wonderful, wonderful blog. And I thought it'd be great to have Mr. Yaup on to talk about those cartoons. So today is our show about the early Hanna-Barbera cartoons. And even though they're not Warner Brothers cartoons or MGM or Disney cartoons, they're not classic in that vein. They still are classic, even though they're limited animation. I don't have a problem with limited animation. I think limited animation can be done really well. And a lot of people don't realize it, but Charlie Brown Christmas is limited animation, or Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, or even How the Grinch Stole Christmas has a lot of limited animation in it. As a matter of fact, a lot of later Warner Brothers cartoons, even the good ones, have limited animation. They have some form of planned animation in it. Maybe not as extreme as Hanna-Barbera, but it's there. And a Melendez feature film, Snoopy Come Home and a Boy Named Charlie Brown, it's fuller animation, but it's still limited animation. And some of my favorite Disney shorts are limited animation. The Saga of Wind Wagon Smith and Toot Whistle Plunk and Boom, famously limited animation. So I have no problem with limited animation because it can be done very, very well. And I think with Hanna-Barbera's early cartoons, I think they had really good writers. I think they had excellent animators. They basically had their MGM animators working for them at the Hanna-Barbera studio, and they were still producing good work. So that's what our show is about today. We're going to talk about those early Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and Mr. Don M. Yaup is going to join us right after this. Don't go away.
Cartoonerific is the place to be to celebrate hand-drawn animated cartoons. The Cartoonerific podcast features interviews with the magic makers behind your favorite animated cartoons, with episodes uploaded every Friday. Or visit the Cartoonerific blog featuring articles about classic cartoon animation. At the Cartoonerific Gallery, view original animation art and memorabilia from your favorite animated films and TV shows. The company store features exclusive swag from the Cartoonerific universe. And coming soon, brand new world premiere cartoons on the Cartoonerific channel. It's all here. Join the fun at www.cartoonerific.com. That's cartoon, E-R-I-F-I-C.com. It's Cartoonerific, saving the universe one funny cartoon at a time. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
You know, I've met a lot of people that call themselves experts on different things, and they're very knowledgeable about their subject, the subject that they specialize in. This gentleman, I don't think he calls himself an expert, but he certainly is. He's researched a lot of different pieces, bits and pieces, for two different websites he has. One is Tralfaz, which is a blog about cartoons and Jack Benny and a lot of different things that interest him. But he also has this other blog, which he very rarely posts to anymore. He was posting to it for well over 10 years, and it's all about early Hanna-Barbera cartoons. It's called Yaup, the early Hanna-Barbera cartoon blog. And the information he's uncovered, you can't find in a book. You cannot find any of this information anywhere except for his blog. And so you'll see when we talk with him how knowledgeable he is about cartoons in general, but specifically Hanna-Barbera cartoons. So without further ado, let us welcome Mr. Don M. Yaup. Enjoy. Hi, Don. How are you doing today?
Oh, hang in there, Brian. What's up?
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about early Hanna-Barbera cartoons and your very unique blog. And I like I said, it's a wonderful resource for anybody who's interested in all the early Hanna-Barbera cartoons. I'm just kind of curious, what inspired you to create a website about early Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
Well, the site actually wasn't supposed to be about the cartoons themselves. Originally, what I wanted to do was put together somewhere where a repository for the names of the background cues that were used in the cartoons. because nobody knew what this music was. I had been hunting around for roughly 25 years. I started in radio in 1975. And of course, you know, we have production music in the background, commercials and so on and so forth.
Sure.
But we never had this particular library. And I had heard it all over the place. And if anyone grew up in the 60s, they would have heard it in industrial films or commercials. So I went on a huge, long hunt for it. And finally, someone sent me a bunch of this music at one time. And so I thought, well, I'll match the names of the songs in the background to the cartoons and where they came up and so on. And I tried to do it on another site, and I thought, well, this isn't going to really work too well because it only allows for one or two pictures. I wanted to do more. So I simply set it up, and with the cues in mind, I reviewed the cartoons, where the cues were, and made some comments, which were actually supposed to be on the side of what was in the actual cartoons themselves.
Yeah, those cues are fun to listen to. So this was kind of reverse engineered, I guess, to create the Hanna-Barbera blog. So some of those cues came from what? Was it the Capitol? It was a Capitol library? I mean, there were
most of them came from Capitol. 1956, they set up the High Q Library. That was Bill Luce that was in charge of that. He wrote a bunch of the music himself as well, between him and John Seeley. And they, because Capitol had connections with EMI in England, they were using Philip Green cues from that library. They had the rights to the Sam Fox Library, so some Sam Fox music ended up in the cartoons as well. In addition, they also used material from another library called Langlois Film Music, which was run by Jack Shainland. So there's an awful lot of Jack Shainland music, especially in the later cartoons. By later, I mean 1950, 59, 60 in there.
Right. I noticed those names, Seeley and what was it? What was the other person's name?
Well, Bill Luce was the main guy. He was, right. I guess his claim to he wrote the theme to Hollywood Squares.
Oh, wow. Well, I noticed those names are in a lot of Warner Brothers cartoons of the 60s. Seeley and
Luce. What happened was there was a period where there was a musician strike. It was one of Petrillo's fairly frequent walkouts. So for six cartoons, whoever the sound cutter was at Warner Brothers just picked music out of the Capitol Library. They did it with a lot more care. In the Hanna-Barbera cartoons, you'll notice that the tunes will go on for maybe almost a minute as mood music. At Warner Brothers, you're using snippets that went down to maybe 6 seconds or even less to try to score it like they would have scored a regular cartoon. I don't think it succeeded very well. To me, you listen to it, and it sounds like Yogi Bear should show up with Bugs Bunny any minute.
That's right. I'm trying to think of the cutter's name over there, and
Craig Brown did.
Craig Brown was Craig he Brown, the cutter?
Yeah, he was the cutter for a long time. Yeah, for a long time he was.
Yeah, he was. He won an Academy Award for sound effects for The Great Race, which was a Blake Edwards movie. Yeah. So anyway, well, that's really interesting. So when you started like linking these cartoons and you started saying, well, this theme was from here and this theme was from this cartoon, when was the big changeover when you went from the music to just the Hanna-Barbera blog?
It's kind of hard to say because it almost was simultaneous. It just was an outgrowth, basically.
Yeah.
I wanted to have the odd comment about the cartoons, and it just didn't seem like one or two lines was going to work. So I said, the hell with it. And I just did the whole cartoon. Anything that struck my mind as I was watching it, I'd make some notes and jot it down and put it on the blog.
That's pretty cool. Now, I noticed that you've done a lot of work with like recreating animated scenes and cycles and stuff like that on the blog, as well as having those music cues on there. And I've always thought that was really neat. What's your favorite Hanna-Barbera character?
A Quick Draw McGraw.
I think that's mine. I think with Yogi Bear.
It's interesting because, as you probably know, that whole series, all 72 cartoons, was written by Mike Maltese. Mm-hmm. And Maltese had come from Warner Brothers, where he was working for Chuck Jones. And you can notice similarities in structures and plots, and then sometimes even the gags, where he borrowed from old Warner Brothers cartoons and stuck them in there. I think of Droop Along Daffy, where it's a Western theme. And there are other Western-type cartoons that Maltese did over there, and suddenly the same gags are showing up with Quick Draw.
Yeah.
And it's just as effective even in limited animation.
Did you find
planned animation? That's what Joe Bart says.
Planned animation. Yeah, it's a nice way of saying it rather than limited animation. But they were truly planned animation. I mean, it was, you know, for everything from storyboards down to the actual animation. You know, they those shots were pretty much planned to so that they can get the most out of them with the least amount of drawings. And
I think what they wanted to do is they wanted to differentiate the kind of animation that had been used in Crusader Rabbit, where there really wasn't a lot of animation. Mm-hmm. In this case, there was more animation that you found in there. So they wanted to use a different term to make it seem like whoever the client was buying the particular cartoon, that they were getting something a little more for their money.
Well, more, I think it was Kellogg's maybe at the time. Was it Kellogg's or?
Through Leo Burnett.
Yeah. And then I think it became Ideal. Ideal became the sponsor of a lot of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons after that.
In the, about what, 1960, when was McGillis, 63?
Yeah.
In there, he picked up that, Ideal picked that up. They picked up, Peter Potamus and a couple of other things. Well, of course, and they kind of stuck their nose into the Flintstones business too.
Right.
Because if it hadn't been Ideal, there wouldn't have been a Pebbles, because that was Ideal's. They wanted a girl character they could sell dolls with. A child, a boy child for Fred was off the table, and they got a girl out of the deal. But that's the way it went, though. Barbera was a hell of a salesman. I keep reading these stories about how he would go in, this I guess in the 70s, he'd go in for pitches with networks, and he'd come up with a sale, and then he'd say to his assistant afterwards, by the way, what did I just sell them? He was a great, he was able to convince anybody to buy anything, it seemed.
Well, I think once you have the success, and I mean, they hit it off with what was the first character that I guess with MGM they were with them. Let's go back to MGM because you know a little bit about that, right?
Okay
so they're with MGM, and they were made the executive producers of the animation division. Quimby, I guess he retired. Fred Quimby left, and then Hanna-Barbera they were in charge of it. And then
At that point, they won 7 Oscars for Tom and Jerry, starting in what I think the first one was The Truth Hurts, 1943. It was somewhere back there. Anyway.
Right. So when they got to the end of the MGM run, basically they had people come down. They're evaluating and trying to figure out what they were going to do with the studio, because the studio was losing a ton of money and they're trying to cut corners. And somebody said, well, we don't need animation anymore. So they came and basically cut them off at the knees, and they said, okay, you got to close down the department in a couple of months. And then they were trying to figure out what to do, but they were already in television animation, weren't they?
Well, in 1956, which is when MGM was still going, Bill Hanna set up a company with Mike Law, who is his wife's brother. They married the twin sisters anyway. Mm-hmm. And another guy named Don Driscoll, and they set up a studio with the idea that they were going to make a new a Crusader Rabbit cartoon. And then suddenly the purported owner of Crusader Rabbit came in and said, no, you can't do this. We own this, so you're going to do something else. Mm-hmm. So this is when the idea of Rough and Ready was born. So they were working on that even while MGM was still making cartoons. Dick Bickenbach was saying that he was drawing layouts for the first series while they were still at Metro.
Wow. Now, Joe wasn't a part of that initially, was he?
No, and I don't know the reason behind that. And we may never know the reason behind it, much like we don't know the reason that Mike Law suddenly wasn't in the picture when Hanna-Barbera set up its studio. There was an interview that was done, and unfortunately there was garble in the interview, so the actual answer doesn't exist anymore. I kind of get the impression that Law didn't really have the money to pony up to be part of it, so he kind of got left out in the cold. But he was working with a Quartet Films anyway,
right,
making commercials, so he was busy enough as it was.
Sure. Well, I know he worked on the initial Hanna-Barbera cartoons for like the Huckleberry Hound show. And he ended
He was freelance. They just call him in to do, he did a couple of cartoons on his own, but they call him in to do scenes that they had to pick up an extra 90 seconds or so.
Right.
They'd contract out and he'd work on them.
I know Pie Pirates, and Pie Pirates is a very funny cartoon. It has great posing in it for limited animation. And Law did the layout and the animation for it. I think he did the entire cartoon.
He did the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. But then later on, you see he's kind of in and out, and he's kind of like a second credit somewhere along the way, but not maybe just doing a few, and then all of a sudden he exits. And so I guess he was doing commercials for all that time. But
right.
But he was an extraordinary talent and, you know, did some great stuff with Tex Avery and don't know what happened there. But anyway,
he was freelancing the whole time he was at Hanna-Barbera, much like Ed Love was too. Ed was never on staff.
Wow.
And so business, I guess, got busy for Quartet. The Lodge just bowed out and said, I've got other irons in the fire I've got to take care of that make me a little more money.
My guess with Joe Barbera is like when they actually incorporated as a studio and maybe to get the financing to do certain things like Rough and Ready, maybe. I'm thinking maybe George Sidney said, you know, you guys were a team here. You'd probably be, you know, marketable as a team in television. And maybe that's how they brought Joe into it. Yeah.
I get the impression that Sidney was the power behind the throne here. He was the first president of HP Enterprises. And he was the guy who set up a meeting with Columbia mm-hmm. to get the distribution for a whole pile of series of cartoons through the 50s and into the 60s.
Right, right. Very, very important. When did Sidney actually get pushed out? Sidney was in there for a couple of years and then...
He was still there until they sold to Taft. He still had his shares.
Wow. So a good 10 years.
He wasn't doing the day-to-day decisions. He just had his cash in there and he kept it in until the time was to sell.
Right. So then he cashed out and Hanna-Barbera also cashed out on that and then it became Taft Studio.
Yeah.
When they actually, so they got Rough and Ready. Rough and Ready was not a full half hour. Rough and Ready was like just basically individual cartoons, and they would. Do you know how that worked with the Rough and Ready? Because
they kind of basically borrowed. Joe and Bill are great at borrowing things. Mm-hmm. They borrowed the concept of a serial from Crusader Rabbit. So they had adventures that went on. So there were two cartoons in each half hour. And to fill out the time, they had a live-action host who was Jimmy Blaine at the first one, anyway. Mm-hmm. And they also had those wretched old Columbia favorites, they keep calling them. But I don't think they're favorites of anybody. Mm-hmm. So they chucked those out the airtime.
Wow. So when they did Rough and Ready, they were already, I know with Joe was probably already, you know, setting up the next thing. As far as what they were going to pitch. And because that's how they kind of worked, right? They would get the thing in production and Joe would kind of bow out and then he would just start working on stuff to sell for the next round or the next year. And so.
Yeah, it seemed like even before they got Rough and Ready on air, which was December 15th, 57. They had already been working on concepts that later became Yogi Bear and Mr. Jinx and Huckleberry Hound. Pretty straightforward. They just put together these cartoons, and Joe started knocking on doors of agencies. Mm-hmm. And finally, they got to Leo Burnett, and it depends on which version of the story you like. Joe has a more dramatized version in later years than he did in the original years. Mm-hmm. The original years, everything was a big success right off the bat.
Oh, but of course. Later, right.
Joe liked to tell a story, so then he tells this story about snow in the winter and trudging through in New York and, oh, I don't know if I can make a deal. And you know, it gets pretty, pretty cliffhangery. Right. But in essence, what he did, he went to Leo Burnett. They brought in Kellogg's. Kellogg's was, they liked the idea. So they bought the half hours and they started distributing it to individual stations across the U.S. They basically bought the airtime. Mm-hmm. It's like an infomercial. It was a cartoon. So they'd buy early evening hours in various markets and put it on the air. And the same thing went for Quick Draw and the other Kellogg series.
So they buy the airtime, they put the cartoon on, then they would sell like the commercials. They'd sell those spots.
Well, it was all prepackaged. So Leo Burnett bought the airtime for Kellogg's, and Kellogg's had all the commercials integrated. And you've probably seen them online, these wonderful spots, which are much more deftly animated than the actual cartoons themselves, where Quick Draw is selling OKs and various other cereals. They're quite nice. But my favorite out of the whole works is the one where Mr. Jinx and Pixie and Dixie are doing the Beatles. It was an Ed Love commercial. Mm-hmm. And Jinx takes off his hat and he has his Beatle wig fall down and there's a guitar and it's really kind of cool.
Wow. Yeah, the commercials, they spend a lot more money on the commercials. And of course, probably the commercials more entertaining than the shows sometimes, maybe later on, but not, but they're definitely better animated. Do you know if they were animated in-house or did they farm those out?
Oh, Lord. I'm trying to figure out who did the original ones. They weren't done in-house originally. Leo Burnett had someone else do them. And I can't remember if it was Playhouse or who it was on the West Coast was doing them.
Right.
They had a commercial division, but they weren't doing those commercials until maybe about 1959 from Disney, who came in and was running the commercial division.
Wait, who?
It was about 1961 when he took over. Art Babbitt.
Art Babbitt, yeah. Art Babbitt was running it. They had a lot of Disney people.
Especially after Sleeping Beauty bit the dust.
Right.
There's a huge layoff. And suddenly all these people end up, a bunch are working for Jack Kinney making those TV Popeyes, and others went to Hanna-Barbera. A few others went to UPA. So they kind of scattered hither and yon.
Right. Yeah. And that was, you know, they were looking for talent. You know, I remember that one of the things that you had on your website was an article where Joe was saying, we're looking for talent. We're scouring, you know, we have everybody in town so far, you know, whoever's available is working for us. And
it was pretty tight in those days, I imagine, too, because they were still doing a lot of animated commercials. So you had all these studios up and down Cahuenga that were doing commercial advertising. I think that the bottom kind of fell out of it in the early 60s,
right,
when it became cheaper to do action than to do animated commercials.
Right.
But for a time, the guys were going like door to door. Virgil Ross was saying that he was freelancing at different commercial studios while he's still at Warner Brothers, and Ken Harris was doing the same thing.
Right, right. They were all doing that. And I think Benny Washam was, he was just doing like Cap'n Crunch commercials and stuff like that. Benny Washam.
Yeah, he would leave Chuck Jones for a while and go work for Jay Ward or somewhere else, but he was in and out as well.
Right, right. Well, it seemed like they were having fun. When do you think that Hanna-Barbera fell apart? Because they were, you know, they grew. They had the one show, then they got Huckleberry Hound. They were doing that. And then they started adding more stuff. And, I mean, the Flintstones must have been a huge project for them. Because I know they got double the money that they were getting for the short cartoons. So three short cartoons would add up to about 20 some odd minutes, and I think the budgets were $6,000 a piece, right? Does that sound right? Or $6,600 a piece?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
And
in the Flintstones case, it was sold a little differently than the syndicated ones, where basically ABC bought the series and they went out and they landed the deals to put the spots in between. So you had Winston's and I think Miles Laboratory,
right,
was the other sponsor. But you're asking about when the studio kind of started going down the tubes. At least for me, I can tell you the first Hanna-Barbera series I turned off was Magilla Gorilla.
Right.
I can explain why. It's because most of the gags that were on there were rehashes.
Right.
I think what happened, the studio just got too big. It forsook the syndicated market, which was changing as early evening hours expanded news-wise and local programming-wise. So they had to find another outlet. And John Mitchell at Screen Gems wanted to get him into prime time, so that's where they put their concentration. Mm-hmm. And then when the primetime cartoon business collapsed, if you want to put it that way, in 1961, they finally found a nice niche in Saturday mornings. In Saturday mornings, the cartoons may have been written by some of the old Warner's guys and theatrical people, but they were directed more at kids. I would say that Quick Draw was far more of a family cartoon. And of course, you know that Huckleberry Hound had a huge following on university campuses and with adults. You can't say that about Saturday morning cartoons. They were aimed strictly at kids, and it became more and more so as time wore on, especially once you got these do-gooder groups in there and started telling the studios what kind of gags they could do.
That's right. Well, we had a little bit of that when I was working on the Mighty Mouse show for Ralph Bakshi, and we had the Reverend Wildman actually kind of step in and make a comment about something that was done in one of the episodes. So we
yeah, that was the cocaine sniffing flower or some stupid thing.
It was a flower that fell apart, and a character sniffed it, and so you know immediately he went there with that, and he saw it as a. And I guess it could be construed like that. I had nothing to do with that one, but we did a lot of wild gags on that show. Getting back to Hanna-Barbera, yeah, I think they had moments of greatness. I think they were, you know, obviously Scooby-Doo is kind of, you know, it came out. I liked it as a kid. It wasn't the same old stuff that they were doing back in the day when they left MGM and they were working on the short cartoons. But, you know, it stood the test of time. But
with Scooby originally, I liked the first couple of seasons in that there's a balance between the comic relief and the mystery aspect. So as a young kid, you could watch the cartoon and try to solve what was going on. Later on, it became a Scooby and Shaggy show.
Yeah. And it kind of, at that point, it just fell apart. Well, you know, you had the, I think Yogi Bear was probably one of the first things that they kind of ran into the ground. I think it was Yogi's Ark Lark. I think that was a show that was on ABC back in the early 70s. And it took Yogi out of his element, out of the park environment, and just put him now saving the planet, which
well, that was
crazy.
Again, you can blame the you know, the groups that were pushing for that sort of thing. So that was the reaction of all the cartoon studios and I guess Saturday morning in general. Yeah, I guess we're going to placate these people, so we'll have message cartoons. There was an interview in the late 50s with Joe Barbera where he's talking about how his cartoons didn't have a message and how that changed within 10 years. Of course, it was out of his hands. Mm-hmm. The network wanted it too, right, because they wanted to placate everybody. So it was kind of like, you know, this is what you got to do, so that's what they did. But from an entertainment standpoint, you still have people today think, oh, this is a great series. There are people like Captain Planet, for God's sake. But you know, yeah. I guess that's what it is. You grow up with this stuff and you just ignore the fact that it was there to pound a message like, don't pollute, don't be a racist. Not that any of this stuff actually ever worked, but right. That's what the people wanted the networks to put on, and that's what the networks put on.
Yeah. I mean, who could forget Super Friends?
I can. I never saw it.
Good for you. Well, there are other shows. I said on another podcast, we were talking about Rubik's The Amazing Cube, which was a Hanna-Barbera show, and the Pac-Man show.
Marty Engels, yeah.
Yeah, Marty Engels, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they had stuff like the Three Robotic Stooges. I don't know if you remember that. It was another
just barely. Yeah. By this point, I was either in high school or had started my career, so I wasn't exactly watching Saturday morning cartoons. I was on the air at 6 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, so
right.
I wasn't going to be watching cartoons.
No, not at all. No, I'm just I'm bringing up that stuff not because I'm just saying this is a period where basically Hanna-Barbera kind of just. They got to the point where they're just selling stuff for the purpose of selling stuff. They weren't into what they were doing. I don't think they were into what they were doing. It was just a matter of, oh, maybe this will sell. You know, maybe we could sell, you know, we can get this. We can get the rights for this. Let's just do this. Let's see if we can pitch this and see if it flies, you know. But
well, the other problem that they had was that Joe and Bill didn't own the studio anymore. So they're at the beck and call of, I guess at that time, it still was Taft.
Right.
And, you know, they're calling some shots, so they can't say no. It's not their company anymore.
It's not their company, but they still have to develop this stuff. And they're still, you know, Joe was still behind, you know, trying to come up with ideas for cartoons and then selling them. And I think the sheer volume of coming up with this stuff probably destroyed the studio. I mean, maybe not in the eyes of Taft at the time, because the company was making money. They were selling all these shows for Saturday morning.
Well, the funny thing with Taft was that they didn't realize when they bought the studio that Screen Gen still had the rights to the older characters, so they had to develop new material.
Now, did Hanna-Barbera still own the characters, but they didn't own the cartoons?
Well, Screen Gems somehow, I don't know what the actual deal was, but Screen Gems had the rights to the older characters, and I think for a 5-year period or something. Then it finally ran out. I'd have to go back and look through the provisions of the deal.
Right.
But who was it? Taft actually wrote a book on that period of when they bought the studio and realized and outlined some of the things that they realized after they bought it, that they didn't own everything.
Right. Going back to the original, those original cartoons, there was the Huckleberry Hound show, and then they spun off what? Yogi Bear? They spun off Yogi Bear and
Yeah.
And then what took the place of Yogi Bear on the Huckleberry Hound show? They
created... the thing happened so quickly, they didn't have all the original cartoons to put in it. Yogi came on the air simply because Kellogg's and Leo Burnett were trying to broker a deal with Hank Saperstein at UPA to do a Magoo half hour. And then Saperstein pulled out of the deal. So they were looking for anything. And lo and behold, there's Joe and Bill saying, you know, we can spin this off. This was October of 1960, and they wanted to put it on the air by January. Well, they didn't have all the cartoons ready yet.
Right.
So we're trying to get to, this is a roundabout way of trying to answer your question, because they put Hokey Wolf in the Huck show, but they didn't have him ready yet. So they were still running Yogi cartoons and whatever else they could fill time with until they got all these Hokey Wolf cartoons ready.
Right.
And the same thing happened on the Yogi series. They were supposed to have Snagglepuss and the Annoying Duck. Well, they didn't have all those cartoons ready, so they were using anything else they could put on for the first three or four or five half hours until they got everything up to speed.
Wow. It was Yakky Doodle, right? Yakky Doodle Duck?
Yeah, I hate Yakky Doodle.
I think
Jimmy Weldon did a wonderful job with him, but I hate the original character.
Yeah.
Because he's this whiny duck that's whining for his mother. Like, I don't want to see some duck whine.
Well,
I want to see something funny.
Well, he was wandering around the Tom and Jerry cartoons, and you wanted to see him actually get cooked in a pot of boiling water. But then he ended up wandering into a Yogi Bear cartoon, didn't he?
Yogi Bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bill Hanna apparently loved the duck. He just loved them. And so that's why when their studio started up, they thought, oh, well, let's get Charlie Shows to put him into this Yogi Bear episode. And he popped up everywhere. It was like Snagglepuss popped up everywhere before he had his own series. I kind of like the early Snagglepuss because he's a villain.
Yeah.
He's a funny villain.
Right. Okay. So they ended up doing the Yogi Bear show. What came after that? I mean, aside from Flintstones. Flintstones was what, 1960?
Well, yeah. And about the time the Flintstones debuted, in fact, before then, if you look at the Life magazine profile of the Flintstones, you'll see Dan Gordon, who was, I guess at the time with Ed Benedict, he was the main character designer. And on the floor, there are a whole pile of these drawings. And in amongst them, there's Touche Turtle and a character was named Harebrain Hare, who never quite got on the air. He kind of morphed into Ricochet Rabbit later on.
Mm-hmm.
So they were on this series of shorter cartoons that they could sell into syndication individually or as a package. And that took a good 2 years to get on the air. So that's what they were working on next from a shorts standpoint. But it took almost, 1962, I think, before they finally got them all ready, because the studio was so busy. Mm-hmm. They had the Flintstones, and then they also had Top Cat in development at the time, too.
Right.
And they had several other series,
Jetsons.
Which it doesn't seem any of them got on the air. They had concepts for a whole pile of different things.
Right. I think it's because Top Cat was not a hit. And then was Top Cat first or was Jetsons?
Top Cat was 61.
Right.
And then Jetsons 62.
Right.
And then they couldn't sell it in 63, but they made one last stab at it at 64 when they put Johnny Quest on ABC.
Was Johnny Quest a hit? I know they had a hard time working on it because they couldn't find enough talented people to work on it.
Well, the other problem was it was just so damned expensive to put on television with effects and so on and so forth, even with limited animation.
Right.
It didn't capture an audience, I think, because people really felt at that time cartoons are for kids. So they didn't get the adult audience that they needed to expand the demographic numbers to be able to sell for a second season. So what happened was that Bill Hanna crunched the numbers and decided a second season just wouldn't fly. It wouldn't be profitable for the studio. So I think it was kind of a joint agreement between ABC and the studio that it wouldn't carry on. The other problem they had was the Flintstones was getting its butt kicked by the Munsters.
Mm-hmm.
So the response of ABC was to switch the two shows, and they put the weaker show, i.e. Johnny Quest, they put it against the Munsters, and they put the Flintstones in a better time slot, so they get at least get another year of sales out of it.
Right.
Because they had all this price that they had to sell, so they didn't want to lose money on that.
I remember going to Shea Stadium back. I think it was Shea Stadium was where the World's Fair was, the New York World's Fair. And they had the, I think it was the Ice Capades, and in the middle of the show, they had the Flintstones characters come out on ice. I remember this because I was maybe 4 or 5 at the time. But I guess it was still while the Flintstones were popular and on prime time. And I just bring that up. You put an article about the Hanna-Barbera characters touring. There was a gentleman that was involved with that. Do you recall this this article that you?
Yeah, and I'm sitting here blanking up because it's been so long since I wrote the story. He was based out of New York. He was Screen Gems, basically their PR flack, mm-hmm. and he arranged all different tours and whatever.
Right.
And they had I've forgotten Eddie's last name, but they had the guy that they had done some touring for Disney, and he was basically kind of an MC. And then they have these costume characters, so they hire people and put them in a Huckleberry Hound suit.
Right.
And they go to department stores or fairs or wherever they could book these things.
I remember at 8 years, maybe 7 or 8 years old, they had the Banana Splits characters, which were, I liked the show when I was a kid, but, you know, of course, you know, when you look at it today, it's not quite as good as you remember it. But I remember...
Well, I don't think they have all the elements today to actually see the show as it originally aired, because my recollection is that they had these laugh-in type little skits with, you know, Paul Winchell voicing stuff in the background.
Right.
And then they'd cut to these live-action Danger Island or whatever features that they did somewhere.
Yeah, it was Donner. Donner was the director. I'm trying to think, what was his first name? He directed
I believe you're correct there. Yeah, yeah. He was.
Yeah, he was one of the directors on, but they also did animated stuff. Around the World in 80 Days, I think they had part of that.
Yeah, and they had, what, Three Musketeers or something,
yes.
I think, too.
Yeah, so it was kooky stuff framing it with the characters created by Sid Marty Croft. So that was interesting. But I remember seeing those characters in person, and I told the story on a previous podcast where when I did some work for Hanna-Barbera for the Jetsons movie, Joe's secretary said, "Would you like to see Joe's office?" And so she escorted me in, and there were the Hanna-Barbera Banana Splits prototypes right in the front table. Yeah. So a little bit of a thrill for me, just because it was just like it took me back, you know, but very neat.
But Screen Gems marketing guy Ed Justin had all this stuff in New York, and basically, we were talking about the Flintstones, and they had all this Flintstones merchandise, and they didn't want to lose the sales on it.
Right.
So that's why they quest and the Flintstones show to give it a better time slot, so it would carry on for, I guess it would have been the sixth and final season.
Right. But the Flintstones has never gone away, because it's been on in syndication ever since. It hasn't left the airwaves.
Well, yeah. Pretty much. And then you have the redevelopments, the teenage Flintstones show, Pebbles and Bam Bam. And right. Then they had Flintstones Kids. I mean, they came up with all kinds of concepts, I guess, that everyone else was using for everything. I mean, I don't know how many kids' versions of shows there were in Cartoon Land in the late 80s, but there must have been a whole pile of them.
Oh, there were. I mean, I think it started with Muppet Babies, and then everybody kind of just jumped on the bandwagon. Because you had Tiny Toons.
Yeah, and the less said about Yo Yogi, the better.
Exactly. What did you think of the new, did you ever watch the new Yogi Bear show that they did in the, I think, the 90s?
I saw bits and pieces of it, because they were using the old Hoyt Curtin stock music.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was probably more dialogue, if that's possible, than there were in the 60s cartoons. I think they tried their best.
Right.
But it just wasn't the same, and I don't know what it was. Maybe it might be because the characters are all Xerox as opposed to hand inked like in the 60s. They look different.
Yeah. Honestly, I think that the artists that they were using back in the late 50s, they were just they just drew better. They knew how to make appealing poses. And I think
they were all veterans too. You know, Muse had been at MGM, mm-hmm. and Law had been at MGM. And Carlo Vinci had been at, Van Buren originally, and then worked for Paul Terry for all those years.
Right.
And Lou Marshall, I believe, was Ray Patterson's understudy. I think he was Ray Patterson's assistant at MGM. So he came up through the system. So these guys have been around an awful long time. You have guys like Bickenbach, who he started with iWorks, I believe it was, in the early 30s. So these guys had lots of experience.
Oh, yeah. Dick Bickenbach was
bringing in new people who were agog with all, like, I'm meeting Tex Avery. And they're trying to be up to speed on these guys that have been around 30 years, and it must have been a real challenge for them, especially if they're dealing with limited animation because they can't go full blast.
Well, I think
it was George Nicholas who was saying it was easier for him to draw in full animation and take out drawings than to draw in limited animation.
Yeah. Well, I heard, like, in the, you know, we're talking about the pose tests of the Tom and Jerry cartoons, and they would say that these things got a lot more laughs from the Leica reel, basically animatic of the storyboards. It would get a bigger laugh because the actions were faster. There were no in-betweens, whatever. So they'd show pose the before and the after, and they'd throw a sound effect in or whatever, and it registered. You know, it was funnier that way. And so
they're outlines too, so they're not filled in like a full colored cartoon. So I think that slows it down a bit, doesn't it?
I think so. I think when you put the color in,
as opposed to having an outline.
Yeah. Well, Tex Avery was notorious for pulling drawings out, and his cartoons move really fast. Sometimes it's just like, you know, it's a pose, and then all of a sudden a swish drawing, and then it's another part of the room, and it's a character in another pose, and it's pretty incredible what they could get out of fewer drawings. And I really believe when Hanna-Barbera started off and they were doing these things, they wanted to make funny cartoons for TV. But I think somehow along the way, you know, just trying to keep the studio busy, trying to, you know, doing one cartoon after another, it just became the General Motors of animation. You know, and
I don't know how somebody like even of Mike Maltese's abilities could write 78 cartoons. And actually, he did 80 that first year he got there, because he did a Huckleberry Hound and a Yogi Bear. How you can do that when you come from an outfit where you're doing maybe 12 cartoons for Chuck Jones? How you can write that much? You got to run out of ideas. And you just simply don't have the time. You're churning all this stuff out. And I think that was the problem. They just had way too much volume. Because the studio was in such demand, because it basically set the tone for television animation.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't know how they do it, or I don't know how they did it, but they somehow got these cartoons produced. But I know that, you know, over a couple of years, they're running out of material real quick. And so when it got to the Magilla Gorilla, which is a very slick looking cartoon, you know, it's, you know, all those cells, the backgrounds, whatever. It's a great, like a great looking cartoon, but it's just not funny. You know, whatever humor that was there was just basically, I don't know, squeezed right out. Because I would see Magilla Gorilla as a kid, and I got bored. I got bored with the cartoons, so I would rather watch a Top Cat or Jetsons episode or one of the original Hanna-Barbera cartoons. Over
Jetsons had marvelous designs. I'm up here in Vancouver, and as a kid, we went down to the World's Fair in Seattle, and there's the Space Needle, and then the Jetsons are on. Well, it's the same thing. So it's really, really neat to see that.
Oh, sure. Well, if you come to New York and you go to the World's Fair grounds, you could actually see those towers that basically they would have a light on the top of. There were like two towers. There was the New York Pavilion, I believe. And you would see that in the Jetsons cartoons.
Tony Benedict was saying that they'd bring in popular mechanics, but various mechanical magazines that look toward futurism, and they'd bring them in. They basically cop the designs, or at least use them as inspirations for what they did on the Jetsons. The same with all these inventions. There's nothing. Now they're going, oh, flying cars. Well, that wasn't original to Hanna-Barbera. That concept had been talked about since the 30s.
No, but the big screen TV, you know, they had that. And did they have the wristwatch?
Well,
kind of, yes.
Dick Tracy had
that, yeah.
all this stuff like the Home of the Future type thing. There are all kinds of magazines in the 50s that had huge spreads on these things, speculating what was going to happen.
Right.
And so they borrowed those kinds of ideas. But because no one's ever seen those, they first saw them in the Jetsons, so they could. The Jetsons came up with all this stuff. I suspect the writers and designers modified things somewhat. So there may be some originality to what was put on the TV screen.
The Yap website is basically, it's all this material you wrote over the last 10 years. How long has that website been up?
2009, I think.
Wow.
I haven't done an awful lot with it for the last few years. Basically, I've said anything that I've had to say.
Well, you posted a tremendous amount of material on there, and you know I encourage anybody to go to that site. You also have the other website that you keep up now, the
Trollfaz.
Trollfaz. Yeah. I'm sorry,
I have
one of those brain things that stopped me from saying that.
That's one of my favorite Jetsons episodes. That and Uniblob. I like the two of them.
Uniblob.
George Nicholas did a whole pile of animation on the. On the Trollfaz episode, where basically the original owner of Astro comes to claim him, mm-hmm. and then they go into this electronic court where they have a robot jury that gives him back to the original owner.
Wow!
And it's lots of fun, and there's a little bit of emotion there too.
Sure,
there's emotion in my favorite Flintstones episode as well. The one I like more than anyone was the debut for the third season, where Dino goes Holly Rock. The one where he falls in love with Sassy, and then he finally gets to meet her and realize that she's a Hollywood phony,
right?
And then Fred, after a scene where he's crying in his home, comes back to claim Dino, and everything's all right at the end of the half hour.
What do you think of the specials they did after that? I mean, they did a special, I think, in 1966, which was Alice in Wonderland one. Was that the one I'm thinking of? They did another.
Well, I saw them when I was a kid. I didn't like it simply because they modernized it. As soon as she fell through the TV set, I just kind of lost interest. And that was right at the beginning.
Right.
But I still can't figure out why and Barney were joined together other than
they were caterpillars.
Well, we got this caterpillar, so let's put them together and do them.
Do a soft shoe thing with them. Yeah.
It's not one of my favorites, but some people absolutely love it. They think it's tremendous.
And then they did a special with Gene Kelly.
Casting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never saw the Gene Kelly one. It was 1960. I never did watch it for whatever reason. So
right.
I can't say anything about it.
It has some technical problems with it because it's live action animation.
Well, I was thinking for 1967 on a TV budget, anything that they could do that would look semi-reasonable would be gravy. Now you could just do it like that, but back then, I imagine there were challenges budgetary-wise to try to combine the two. It's not like they had the kind of budget where Esther Williams is swimming in water, like MGM has this huge bloody amount of money.
Right?
They had what the sponsor would give them, so I can kind of give them a pass on any bad technology,
right.
Considering the money, considering the year it was put out.
Right. Well, then again, it was small TVs, and you can get away with a lot more on a small TV than if you watch this thing like on a big screen today. All the imperfections, just they're glaring, just really incredible.
Well, yeah, we still had a black and white set in 1967.
Yeah, so did I. There was another show that they did. I think it was the not Huckleberry Hound. It was the more. It was like a Mark Twain thing with. Oh God, it was a live action animated show.
Yeah, it was Chris Shea, and I thought that had been a series, hadn't it been?
I thought it was a series, but I don't think it lasted too long. I think it was maybe six episodes,
no.
Or was it Huck Finn? It was Huck Finn, and
yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. All those shows are available. I guess they're putting all the stuff out. Warner's is just putting everything out now. So
yeah, other than the end of the Huckleberry Hound show and Quick Draw, everything is out there. I guess, and Rough and Ready, people still want to see that.
Yeah, is there a particular cartoon out of those early years that you really like? Out of the whole,
I can think of a scene that I liked. And that was, and it's very, and it, it's very Warner-esque. It's you could tell Maltese wrote this thing, and that's at the outset where Huck is, or where Quickdraw is shooting guns off a fence. So he goes bang, and he blows the smoke off his gun, and he goes bang again, mm-hmm. and he gets the order all ass backwards, and he ends up shooting himself in the face. But it's very much it's very much like a like something Daffy Duck would have done. It's kind of a non-dialogue version of the rabbit season, duck season, rabbit season, duck season, mm-hmm. where they're going back and forth, screwed up. That's basically what it is. It's the same gag. Yeah. And then there's the El Kabong is great because it's just such a non sequitur. Here's this guy flying on a rope that's hanging from God knows where. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, but it's very funny.
It is very funny. I actually prefer that. I like Quickdraw McGraw. I like the show, but I really liked it when it was El Kabong. And
Maltese is a big fan of he was a big fan of Zorro, and that's why it developed. He was also a big fan of Douglas Fairbanks Sr. in the silent films.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he did that character. He wanted to do something along those lines.
I'm just going to mention a character, Snuffles. Wasn't
that's
it?
Right? Yeah.
So
part of the reason, other than the fact that they were really smart with this because they didn't use the routine that often. I think Snuffles is in something like 7 cartoons. It may be 6.
Right.
Part of it at the behest of Kellogg's because they were selling dog biscuits. So they're commercial tie-in. But they used him just enough where his routine didn't get tiring.
Yeah.
So you with it. If you had him on every week, I don't think it would work because you'd run out of ideas with him. And so, this is what we're talking about. The studio just basically ran out of ideas when they're putting these series on the air.
Yeah.
So they're regrouping old ideas. So Huck ideas would show up in a different series, like Sneasley and Breezley or whatever.
Right.
And you're just going, well, I've seen this before and right. It was done better.
Right. Well, for people listening, if you don't know who Snuffles is, it's a dog. And basically he would call in the dog to kind of help him. Right. And then the dog would demand a snack. Do you remember what the snack was
called? Yeah, he was a completely amoral character. All he existed simply to eat dog biscuits. He didn't give a damn who gave them to him. Just as long as he had his dog biscuits, that's all he supported.
That's right.
So if a bad a dog biscuit, he'd be on the bad guy's side. And if Quickdraw gave him one, he'd be on Quickdraw's side. He was completely amoral. It's a great concept.
It was a great concept, and it kind of fueled some of the later stuff that they did because not going to say it's like
Muttley, yeah.
You had Muttley.
Yeah, Muttley and his medals, yeah. It was the same routine.
Same routine, and right down to Scooby-Doo. It's like a Scooby snack, right? But I think the thing, the difference with Snuffles was that he would have the dog biscuit, and then he would writhe around in ecstasy, eating this dog biscuit, and then somehow he would end up in the air, and then he would float down on his back. And I thought it was hysterical because
funny thing was that the studio cheaped out, and they could have reused that animation over and over, but they did in a couple of cartoons, but they didn't in all of them. So there's one cartoon where Ken Muse animates a version of it. Mm-hmm. There's another where Dick animates a version of it. There's
Dick
another
Lundy.
Bob Bentley animates
a version of it. Bob Bentley. Yeah, you're fading in and out, so that's why I'm repeating the name. So Lundy, okay. Dick Lundy, Bob Bentley, and who was the other one?
Ken Muse.
Ken Muse, yeah. Who was the fastest animator over there? It had to be Ken Muse, right?
Yeah, it was Muse. He had I think what it was, Carlo Vinci once said that he was pissed off that he couldn't match Muse's footage amount. Carlo was half that, but that still half of what Muse was doing was it was pretty fast. Muse could churn out a cartoon. I think it took him a week. He could do 7 minutes in a week.
Wow. That's crazy. Even with limited animation to do that, because I think the animators at Hanna-Barbera, I think each one could do maybe 100 feet on average per week, which that's a little bit over a minute. So with limited animation, that's very doable. It's just that once again, it has to be planned out, and that's why some of those scenes can be reused. They would reuse the actions, or they would get tighter on the character, and then just mouth moves and stuff like that, and use the
And you get into Pixie and Dixie, and there are an awful lot of cycles.
Yeah,
so that's footage as well.
Yeah, run cycles where they'd have four, just basically the character would be stationary, but then the legs would be going and there'd be four frames per cycle of a run.
Yeah.
Or 6 frames for a walk or something like that, or 8 frames for a walk.
Yeah. It varied from animator to animator. I think Lou Marshall did 4 frames for a run cycle, and Muse did 6. And Carlo, I mean, he would have it for at least for the first couple of years. He would come up with different walk cycles or run cycles for all the characters. They're all individual,
mm-hmm.
So it wasn't the same time, which made the cartoons look different. It wasn't like you're watching the same thing you saw last week.
Yeah, he would come up with interesting poses. Carlo Vinci, yes, he's a great, great animator for limited animation. He did a wonderful job. But
there's some great work in there. I think Mike Logg has the best poses in the Pixie and Dixie cartoons. He has outrageous expressions, and these were things that you wouldn't find in, say, a 1960s cartoon. You wouldn't find this in Touche Turtle.
No,
the kinds of expressions that Law would use on Huckleberry Hound, or especially on Mr. Jinx. I love his Jinx drawings.
Mm-hmm. They're wonderful. Carlo Vinci's Jinx drawings are pretty fun too. I mean,
there are some of them. It's kind of funny because you can look at it and you go, this looks like it could have been in a Mighty Mouse cartoon. So he never did lose that style of drawing. It still surfaces every once in a while.
Yeah.
And somebody, I can't remember who it was now. It'll come to me after we're done. Was saying when Carlo was at MGM, when Joe Barbera brought him out, that they had to basically, the assistants had to redraw his Toms sometimes because they looked too much like a Terry Toons as opposed to an MGM cat.
Right, right. But he had the animation down, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the story is fairly well known amongst fans that he was the guy who trained Joe Barbera, and Barbera got hired by Van Buren in 1933, I think it was.
Right. Never forgot that. So, yeah. Wow. I'm glad you were able to join us today. I think it's a nice talk about Hanna-Barbera, just letting people know about stuff. Hopefully people will go back and revisit some of this stuff. The one thing I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you really know, we're talking about, you know, the first season of the Huckleberry Hound show was made available. The first season of Yogi Bear was made available. But the only thing that I saw made available for the Quick Draw McGraw show was something on a compilation DVD of all the Saturday morning cartoons. And they put one episode on there, maybe two on these compilations. I think it was Saturday Morning Cartoons. I think that was the name of it, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Right.
Do you know why they're not releasing these cartoons? Why they're not going to Season 2 of Huckleberry Hound?
Poor old Earl Kress, you know, Earl wanted, he wanted these cartoons put on DVD so badly. And he was the one that ended up researching the music rights. And what happened was that part of it was they couldn't find the Jack Shanlon cues to clear, but the other was that one of the widows of one of the composers of the stock music, the rights had reverted back to his estate, and she refused to allow it to be used for the amount of money that Warner Brothers wanted to pay. And so they looked at it and said, we didn't make much of a profit on the first season of the Huck cartoons. We don't see much of a profit here. So they wouldn't pay for the music.
Ah, it's a shame.
The other problem that Quick Draw had originally, was that Earl was going through a rather shoddily put together archive at the old Hanna-Barbera building. I guess they'd moved to Burbank, hadn't they? After Turner bought them. But their archives were, if you want to call them that, were such a mess. They had stuff in boxes. They had no idea what they had.
Right.
So he couldn't find copies of a lot of things, like the little cartoons between the cartoons.
Right.
They couldn't find half hours. And for some reason, Leo Burnett didn't have them. Although they had the Huck half hours. I have a whole list that Earl got from Leo Burnett showing what they had in their possession. But they didn't have the Quick Draws, so he was trying to reconstruct these things. Well, then the bottom fell out with the stock music, and then that just ended the whole idea. So I, as much as I really think they should be on DVD, and I'd love to see them, or streaming, or doing something, I don't see it coming on a home video. I think the time's passed, which is too bad, because they're wonderful little cartoons.
They are wonderful little cartoons. I mean, there's always ways to see these things if you really want to see them, but Unfortunately, you'd have to look for the original 16 millimeter prints that were distributed to the stations back in the day, because I think that's how.
And most of them are in black and white too.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're Leo Burnett did have, at least for the Huck series, they had two 35 millimeter color masters that were in their possession. Whether they had the same thing with Quick Draw, I suspect they did, but nobody seems to know what these things are now.
If there's a will, there's a way somehow. If you want to see them, I'm sure there's a way of seeing them. Thank you for coming on here. I appreciate it. You are a wealth of information. I'm glad you put together this website. I know there's a lot of people that may not have thanked you for it, but I thank you for it, and I thank you for them, because it's a wonderful site to really revisit all those old Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and you've done Hanna-Barbera well by doing that. It's a celebration of their early work, so thank you for doing that. Appreciate it.
Okay, Brian.
Okay, Don, thank you.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Well, that's just about it for today. Next week, Disney animator extraordinaire and the mightiest animator in the universe, Bill Waldman, he'll be joining us, and he'll be talking about his career at Sullivan Bluth Studios, Warner Brothers, and becoming a Disney animator, working on a bunch of different movies like Atlantis, Pocahontas, Mary Poppins Returns, the special sequence in Beauty and the Beast, Human Again. He'll be talking about that and a whole lot more. Next week. It's going to be a two-parter, so that'll be the first of two parts, so please come back for that. If you really enjoy this podcast, the best compliment you can give us is by telling a friend. So let them know that we're on every Friday, new episode every Friday night, and I'll give you a tip. If you want to listen to it early, go to cartoonerific.buzzsprout.com. You can listen to it on Thursday night. It hits all the services either late Thursday night or Friday. So if you have to listen to it and you can't wait, Thursday night, cartoonerific.buzzsprout.com, and you can listen to it. If you go to our website, you can do the same thing. Go to www.cartoonerific.com. And just scroll down to the bottom of the page. You'll get the latest episode. You could do that, and you can also hear it right there first thing Thursday night. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening. It's a lot of fun to do these podcasts, and we have some great episodes coming up. Willie Ito is going to be joining us in the weeks ahead. We have Mark Arnold, who wrote the book on the Patty Freleng cartoons, and I just started there like Porky Pig. But no, we'll be talking about that. And then we're going to have an episode talking about collecting animation art. And we're going to have special guest Debbie Wyson from the Animation Art Gallery in California. So please, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have a terrific week. And we hope to see you again real soon. Thank you for tuning in.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.